Welcome to Bending the Arc. This show is dedicated to being in conversation with individuals and representatives of groups and organizations working for fair and equal justice in Shasta County. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Ebony Higgs and Tracy Neal of our probation department, and particularly related to juvenile justice and the juvenile rehabilitation facility. You're listening on community radio, coming to you from Round Mountain in California. My name is Sharon Brizalera.
Okay. Are we live or just recording?
We are just recording.
Oh, so you can edit us.
Yay.
I can, minimally.
Okay.
Ebony, do you want to say something?
Hello, this is Ebony.
Oh, perfect. So welcome to both of you. Thank you so much for being here and joining us in conversation. And I'm going to let you all introduce yourselves. And if you could tell us your name, your title or position, a little bit about how long you've worked for juvenile justice and what initially drew you to your work.
Hi there, this is Ebony Higgs, Deputy Probation Officer with Shasta County Probation. I have been in the field doing the work for almost about 10 years, and what drew me to doing probation is my love for working with children and families. Mm-hmm. And so I thought there is no better way to do that than just being at the groundwork and working with all the families I get to.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Hi, Sharon. Thank you for having us today. We're super excited to be here. I'm Tracy Neal. I'm the Chief Probation Officer with Shasta County. I've been with Shasta County for about 10 years, and I've been in the field of probation for about 26, 27 years. So I've had the opportunity to work for two other probation departments. You know, what really led me to probation is when I was in college, I had to complete, a number of community service hours and different volunteer work in the community. And I was having a hard time trying to find my fit. And at the time, my professor suggested, hey, you should volunteer at the juvenile hall. And I did, and I absolutely loved the work. I loved working with the youth. I loved the structure of the Humboldt County Juvenile Hall. And it just really started my passion for wanting to work with young people and adults and really supporting the rehabilitative work that we do with our population.
Mm-hmm. And it's got to be challenging at times between things that are coming from the state, the challenges that youth bring, as well as their strengths. What about the work or your experience has kept you going? What gives you motivation or strength to remain involved?
It is actually the results and just really building those connections with the families. They don't just come across our desk and then they're done. It's we're getting to know the grandparents, who often are guardians. We're knowing the parents as they're going through their journey, and the youth. And even sometimes if we're around long enough, we see the youth have children. So it's just seeing that change and seeing the work and being involved on duty, off duty. We see them in the community. And so it's just that reward of saying you've gotten through this. And you've grown so much, and so that keeps us going.
So Sharon, I would agree with what Ebony's saying. It's definitely the work and the outcomes that we look forward to. As you know, the state is constantly changing in lots of impacts on, you know, from the state on the probation level. And, you know, we undergo changes in legislation every single year. And even though the work is challenging and it has to do with us identifying and implementing new programs, it really does get us back to the change that we're seeing in people's lives, in the improvements, in the role that the staff and we have in that change, and really supporting them and walking alongside them as they receive the services in order to make improvements in their lives.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. And it's been great to have both of you in different moments speaking to the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition about your work. And I know people have, it's opened people's eyes to a lot of things that you do. And one of the things I hoped in our conversation we could do is, I think in the community, often you find people who hear juvenile justice, the juvenile justice division, and think exclusively of the juvenile rehabilitation facility. I've got some questions about that name in a little bit, but how do you begin to explain to people in the community what the juvenile justice division is and what it does?
So the juvenile hall is quite literally just one piece. It's not our focus piece. It's one of those emergencies. We really need to give a lot of services, but when we're talking about juvenile justice, we're talking about mental health. We're talking about parenting. We're talking about drug and alcohol. We're tackling all kind of mental, all kind of faucets in someone's life. It's not just put them in a cell, which is not the way people envision it. If you ever seen juvenile justice on Netflix, it gives you like one vision of what this is, what it is, and it's like, well, no, it's not. So we're talking about whatever they need. We're here to help them. Sometimes we're doing housing and housing services, and we're cooperating with other agencies in the community to get them those services. So we're kind of like a hub of whatever you need. Let's figure it out.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I think it's really important. I don't think people really understand juvenile probation and juvenile justice and really what that means. When it comes to a young person encountering law enforcement or struggling or maybe, you know, engaging in delinquent behavior, we're really the gatekeeper of what happens next and really identifying, you know, what is the appropriate next steps. And so unlike the adult criminal justice system where, you know, somebody gets arrested and they get referred to the district attorney's office for prosecution, after a youth has an encounter with law enforcement and maybe it is an arrest or some delinquent behavior, that referral gets referred to the juvenile division. And it's up to the intake staff to really meet with the young person, meet with their family, really understand what's going on with that young person to determine next steps. And a lot of times it is a diversionary program, or we connect those families or the young person with community-based organizations and really work to support them within the community. But it's really an important piece, and I don't think everybody understands that, but the juvenile division is really an important part of the justice system when it comes to a young person.
Mm-hmm. And can you say a little bit more? I think people are, like you said, I mean, more likely to think about a youth that comes and then they're in the juvenile hall and, you know, and they may or may not know what's offered there. But for a youth who comes and undergoes that intake process that you're saying and referrals to diversionary programs, what's an example of what that could look like? What kind of programs are you partnering or connecting with for a youth who doesn't stay in juvenile hall?
So a lot of our partnering is with a lower level kind of services. So we always run the risk model. We don't want those diversionary kids involved with our more high risk youth. And so a lot of times that's something simple as just a little bit of AA. Maybe they tested something out and they got caught the one time they tested something out. Sometimes that's just like a little therapy, some counseling, because there's a big change in the family home. And so we refer them to counseling. And sometimes it's just something that was super spontaneous that they probably didn't think was illegal. And now you're going to do some community service. And don't do it again. They already know. They're like, I can't believe I did that. But kids are impulsive and it happens. It's just something that's part of life. And so we try to divert them to wherever is going to meet meet that need first at the lowest level possible, and whatever organization can provide that for them. So it's just a wide list. It's not one only that we used. And that comes in the evaluation process at the beginning. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Sharon, we're very fortunate. We have so many great community-based organizations in our community that provide an array of services. And so really it's up to the probation staff to kind of identify what those top criminogenic needs are and really connect them with services, with the goal of, you know, diverting them from the criminal justice system. Now, we do have some youth that need a higher level of support or care. And then if that's the case, we step in and provide that support. And that could be mean a higher level of supervision, referral to the district attorney's office for a juvenile petition and formal court action. But I think it's really important for the community to understand that when we think about juvenile justice in our juvenile division, we offer an array of services at a variety of different levels according to the youth's need as well as the family's need.
Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned parenting before. And I'm wondering if you can speak to the kind of parenting support that you're provided, a little bit about the parent project as well as other ways that you interact with families.
Okay, so we have a kind of a multi-level kind of system. So we have our parent partners who are amazing at just working through those home struggles and kind of coaching our parents through those tough times. And then the parent project with comes with parent partners. That is, we call them our strong-willed children. Sometimes they're like, I've raised 10 kids and this one kid is giving me the biggest problem. And we're like, well, that's your strong will. You have to raise them a little differently. And so the parent project is about how do you raise them differently, because you have to change a lot of things that you've done or you've grown up doing. Your parents have told you this is how you do it, and it just doesn't work with a strong-willed child. You have to get really creative at meeting their needs. And a lot of times when we're doing that program, it's about having active supervision. Like, you have to have them involved in stuff. Like, but of course you can't watch them 24/7. But how are you going to keep them busy enough to where they're going to school, they don't have all the free time to run up and down the streets? The program talks about just talking to your children. It's something that happens when if those of us who are surviving or have survived teenagers, then there's this breakdown in communication that happens. And it's all of a sudden, no one's speaking the same language. And so in Parent Project, we're talking about taking a step back and listening to them, because they really just want to be heard at this point. And you'll be amazed at what you find out. Like, it doesn't matter how small it is. You have to think about, how did I feel when I was that age? What did I go through when I was that age? Because a lot of times they just have really big feelings and they're valid. Mm-hmm. And so the Parent Project really works on just changing the way you do things so you can understand your child and where they are and get them to where they need to be.
Yeah, and I just wanted to, Tracy, I want to hear what you have to say too, but just clarifying for folks, these are parents or caregivers of the youth that are in the system, not necessarily parenting teens.
So not necessarily, and both Ebony and I both have our finger up, because the Parent Project, it's best practice. So it is a model that's recognized as being successful and proven by evidence. But we offer the class, and we put it out to everyone in the community. And so there's sometimes where facilitators have so many people that have enrolled that we have a couple of different cohorts. And so while we provide it to youth and family, you know, or pro-social supports that are within our system, we also offer it to parents of just people in the community, of youth in the community.
It's a great diversion kind of program. So our parent partners, we go out to the middle schools and let the counselors know, hey, we have this program. If you think it will apply to anyone who comes across your door, send them our way. And we do. Mm-hmm. We get a lot of parents who are like, I don't know what to do. Sometimes we have parents who have been disjointed from their children, and so they're just coming into parenting halfway through. And so they want to know those skills to get through it. So it's a great diversion practice as well.
Yeah, and when we host the class, we put it out on our social media, we share with the schools and different partners, and so we do get a lot of referrals and a lot of interest from people, you know, across the community. We're very fortunate to have great facilitators and be able to offer it.
Great. Well, and we can put a link to the project and to your social media in the show notes for folks later. I know there'll be interest in that. And, you know, you had mentioned juvenile hall, but here our hall is called the Juvenile Rehabilitation Facility. What were some of the thinking behind that name? And also, was there support initially for naming it the Juvenile Rehabilitation Facility?
Yeah, so our juvenile rehabilitation facility, we opened our doors. I think we had our ribbon cutting in November of 2013, and we made the transition into the new building in January of 2014. But the process started many, many years prior to that, because we did get a grant from the state to build the new facility, which we needed very badly. Our prior facility was, built in the 1950s and had some upgrades, but it was really a facility that was focused on detention and incarceration. And so when we were fortunate to get the grant, a lot of work went into the new facility, and we really wanted something different than just detention. We really wanted to be something besides a juvenile hall, and so we really identified and came up with the name of Juvenile Rehabilitation Facility, and we frequently call it the JRF. Mm-hmm. And it really sets the stage for operations and how we do business within our facility, because our focus is really rehabilitation and providing services to change lives.
Mm-hmm. And for someone who hasn't been in the facility, what about the design or the structure of it is different, and what do you see promoting that rehabilitation?
Yeah, so if you walk in our old facility and then into our new facility, you immediately see drastic changes. So the new facility is really focused on natural light in a lot of windows, in very airy, with high ceilings, and it's really developed for a lot of program space and a lot of space for youth to be able to participate in individual counseling, group counseling. We have a great visiting area that really allows for family and pro-social supports, to come in and spend time with their youth, their young person, and really be able to engage in conversation. But it just provides the light, the structure, the space really provides for an environment that encourages treatment and it really encourages youth to feel more comfortable and be able to, you know, grow in the space.
And, you know, the terms when I'm out in the community and there are common terms, this is just not related only to the criminal legal system, but that everyone uses, but uses a little differently. And rehabilitation and also restorative justice are terms that I find that people mean slightly different things when they use them. So I wanted to ask the two of you, how do you define those terms, and why does it matter to have that kind of framework in the work you do?
Okay, so when we're talking about rehabilitation, it's one piece of restorative justice. So and when we're talking restorative, we're talking about the youth or adult, if depending on where your case is, but we're talking about the youth and the victim and making sure that they become whole. So when we're talking about come whole, that means the victim has to deal with lowering PTSD. So lowering PTSD in our victims because of what happened, but also dealing with whatever need the youth has. So sometimes right now it's a lot of mental health. And so it's a lot of getting those mental health services to our youth. It's about a lot of drug and alcohol treatment for our youth, and also making sure that when our youth go back in out into the community, that the community feels safe to have them there and they're not being judged. Because a lot, if you go back into other areas, the youth are forever judged for something that they did at 13, 14, 15. And that's not the whole point of restorative justice. We want them to feel normal. We want them to have a life that they can be proud of, that they can look back on and say, I did that. And also have the community say, yeah, you did, and I support you. So that's where I look at restorative justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sharon, I think that's a great question. You know, when we think about rehabilitation, it's really the treatment and the services in what a young person needs in order to, you know, resolve whatever may be going on with them, and as well as the family. And it really is focused on, you know, those top criminogenic needs and those driving factors that, you know, push a youth into criminal behavior. And then when we think about, you know, restorative justice, I think, you know, exactly what Ebony's talking about. It's restoring the victim, and it's, you know, about incorporating certain practices, restorative practices, into that rehabilitative process. And so that's when we start to think about restorative chats or restorative circles, creating an environment that's engaging not only the young person, but other young people or people in their lives or victims, in order to have that process complete. And so we had a young person recently that had a struggle with, you know, a certain group in the community, and Hope City came in and really coordinated and orchestrated the restorative process. And by the time it was over, the youth was sitting down with that group, those victims, in really having this conversation and hearing it from both sides to not only restore the victims, but to restore the youth in a positive way for them to kind of move forward, which in itself is so powerful. I mean, to have a young person that has committed a crime against a victim or violated that victim in some way, and to have them sitting at a table. And of course, there was months of work that went into making sure the youth was ready, making sure participants were ready, making sure the victim was ready, you know, doing a mock, you know, process with the youth. You know, there's a lot of background that goes into it, but I mean, for that youth, it was life-changing to be able mm-hmm. to sit with the victims, be able to hear each other's story, hear how those victims were impacted, to hear how that youth was impacted, and really come to a resolution that both parties want to move forward. I mean, it's just very powerful, and it makes a significant difference. And so, you know, we are here at Shasta Probation strong proponents of restorative practices, and because we have seen and we know the power that it can play, and it really can make the difference in a youth and going forward and in not having any issues.
Mm-hmm. Are there other, it sounds like some of the restorative practices are all the preparation that goes into an awareness of what happened as the result of your actions, and being able to listen and communicate, that meeting, perhaps it's community service. Are there other elements or core practices that you'd like people to understand that are involved in the larger process?
The one thing I if I'm answering this correctly, mm-hmm. is to allow time. Something that I find is most difficult with restorative justice is everyone wants something immediate, want an immediate result or a result that they want. And it takes time to change thinking. It takes time to get everyone to the table and to be patient with that and understand that if something is going to be done right, it is going to take some time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like the time to make sure that it's authentic, that the skills are there. And you have a range of programs and services at the JRF that help with those pieces, correct? With the changing, yes, the thinking. Can you tell us a little bit about those? What are some of the core ones? And does it depend on the, each youth might have a different, be involved in different services?
Right. So we do have some core ones. One that I think is probably the most important, especially when we get our youth in for the first time, is called ICBT, Individual Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. We say that's for all of our youth because there's some reason why they've come across our threshold, and we want to make sure that we're supporting you in this transition that you're going to be going through and start getting the help, the therapy, the counseling, and the behavioral skills from the very beginning. Other programs that come a little bit after, depending on the situation, would be our ART, which is aggression replacement therapy. We have more recognition therapy. We have stuff like Boys Council and Girls Council, Towards No Drugs. I got a packet that was about, it was about 10 pages long, which it's a good thing because since we've moved towards this really rehabilitative nature of the juvenile hall, there's been a plethora of services that come in. So Leaders for Tomorrow comes in, and of course we offer them, I'm missing you. There's so many.
Sharon, so what happens when we have a youth in the system, we always do an assessment to determine what their needs are. But we do have an array of services for young people. And Ebony has named off a handful of very important ones. But something that we also do a lot of at the JRF and in our juvenile division is we offer a lot of pro-social activities, because for years and years and years, one of the factors, one of the top criminogenic needs for our young population was lack of social and pro-social and recreational activities. That was one of the driving factors. So we have at the JRF a nice balance of rehabilitative treatment programs and then pro-social activities to engage the youth. And then what we really have worked hard to do is to make sure that if we have a service and a treatment option in the JRF, we also offer that at our juvenile division. So whether a youth is in the facility or in the community, we have this continuum of care so that youth can continue those services and continue to thrive. And something that we've been really fortunate this last year is we transitioned our medical and our psychiatric care to Shasta Community Health Center, which has really enhanced services for youth in the facility, but also when they're in the community, they have that same access to those treatment, and so there's no lapse in care, which is very important because, let's be real, and I think Ebony would agree, we have some youth that are in the facility, they're back in the community. They transition back in the facility, back into the community. And so we do see that. We see youth that, you know, do need that level of care at certain points. And we want to make sure that if they're getting aggression replacement therapy training in the community at our juvenile division, we also want to have that in the JRF so that that treatment can continue.
Mm-hmm. So in the JRF, and then also connecting them with those services when they transition out.
Mm-hmm.
And is there a particular transition plan that happens?
It is. It's actually called the transition plan.
Oh, that's very nice.
So we look at where they're going to school, if they have any medical appointments coming up. Of course, if we're going to be meeting with them, it talks about if they have any counseling appointments. And just like Tracy said, it's been amazing to have the mental health being able to go in and out, because I've been seeing a lot of consistency when, especially for our youth or our medications, and a lot of consistency when we're doing the therapies out of custody. So it's been amazing.
Ebony, can you talk a little bit about CFTs?
Yes. So CFTs are children and family team meetings, and those are essential. We do them whenever we are releasing a youth back to his home. And so who's at the table for that? We usually have someone from SCOE, Shasta County Office of Education. We have, of course, the parents and the youth. The youth being there is very important because they need to put their input. We usually have someone there for mental health. If they have different IEPs, we try to make sure not only is the IEP teacher there with SCOE, and then whoever else they feel is a very big support for them. So sometimes these meetings can get very big, but they're very productive. It's about making a plan of you're going to transition out. How can we support you as you transition back into community? That's the whole point of CFTs on the transition side.
You know, and one of the things, government agencies and nonprofits all over recently, it seems that everyone is in need of more staff to meet the capacity of what's out there. How do you all manage the volume of youth that need these kind of services? You and your partners, because everyone seems to be experiencing the same thing.
So I can answer that on the ground level. It takes teamwork. It really does. It's knowing everyone has their specialty in our department and division. And so it's knowing whose specialty is what and just being able to communicate, I need this to happen. Can you help me? Because it's life, it's a community. So things do happen, and vacations happen, and everything happens. But it's really a teamwork. I can say that it's never been we're out on the island by ourselves. If we need help, or if a kid needs help and another DPO or JDO, because now our kids are assigned their JDOs and they work through with them while they're in the JRF, it's reaching out to whoever is on that team and bringing other people in. And so that support that we're giving each other is really helping things move along and just making sure that everyone's getting what they need.
And can you just say what a JDO is?
Oh, sorry. Juvenile Detention Officer.
Perfect. And Tracy, did you want to say anything else
about
that?
You know, Sharon, the only thing that I would add is we're so fortunate in our juvenile division because the staff we have working in the juvenile division are so passionate about working with young people and families. And so we've had a lot of consistent staff. And so the team at the juvenile division has become very close and strong. And I think we're just adding potentially a new staff member for the first time in a while. And so there's just lots of consistency in the division. So we've been so lucky.
Great. And I was going to ask you about one particular program that's gotten a lot of attention recently, Rivers Edge Academy. I believe there was a Mike Mangus, I think, came out and did a story, and there's a lot of awareness about that program. So I wanted to hear from you all, for our listeners, who is eligible for that program and what are your takeaways from the success that you are seeing?
So for Rivers Edge Academy, there's little that's not eligible outside of having enough confinement time, which is time that you're allowed to stay within the facility, which is based on what happened in court. But far as Rivers Edge, we have used it for placement youth who haven't done, it's not that they haven't done well, but we want them close to their families. They do so much better when they are able to have those regular visits with their family. They're able to have those regular calls with their family. And then the services in the hall in the REA program itself are a higher intensity level, and so they're able to be supported better in that respect. But when we're talking about REA, there's really only two criteria I think we have that excludes them from that, which are kind of, they're kind of up there, the criteria for that. But generally speaking, anyone who would benefit from the program that we believe this is for you, we want you to be able to go back in the community as soon as possible, but you're just not quite ready yet because it does so many programs in the community, so much community service. I always talk about my favorite time when I took my kids trick-or-treating on Halloween and I saw REA there with all the youth and they're passing out candy. And so it's real live. You're getting out there, you're connecting with, you know, your own community where you stay. And so it's not much that says no, you can't do REA, but we try to keep it to where those who need it the most, because it mm-hmm. does require a lot of commitment from our mm-hmm. youth, a lot of dedication of time, but it's also most beneficial as well.
And so they have a somewhat longer stay.
They do. So generally speaking, we would like for them to have at least 1 year. Now, I haven't seen any of our youth max that year out mm-hmm. at all. Mm-hmm. A lot of youth, even one of my youth who is in there currently, she's working on actually getting her own house and job. And so it's not a, you're going to be in there and then you're just kind of on your own. It's like, no, let's get you set up with everything you're going to need when you leave here. And so that's what actually takes the time up for our REA mm-hmm. kiddos.
Yeah, so Sharon, let me give you in the audience a little background on River's Edge. So River's Edge Academy opened last April of 2021. In really, how did we get here? How did we come up with, we need an academy in our JRF? So we were looking at and trying to understand youth requiring out-of-home placement. So youth that would traditionally go to group homes, go out of county for treatment outside of their home. And we really started to look at the numbers, realizing that we were placing a lot of kids in group homes, up to 20 to 25 at any given time. And what we were seeing is in 2015, there were some legislative changes, and we saw the group home capacity shrink. So we saw a lot of youth sitting in the JRF for long periods of time, waiting placement. We were seeing placements fail our youth and terminate them rather rapidly. You know, and then we were also seeing those youth that when they were being successful in a group home, they were doing the great work. We would transition them back into the community, back into their family structure that didn't have any change. And so the behavior, things that came up rather quickly. And while that youth had progressed, they would often deteriorate when they returned to their family setting. And so we really started looking at the options, and we were very intrigued by the Coastal Valley Academy, which is in San Luis Obispo County. And so we really started to work on developing our own academy. And when I say academy, it is an academy, but it is also our camp in our in-custody treatment intensive rehabilitation facility. And so sometimes people will say to me, well, Tracy, let's go back to having Crystal Creek. Well, Crystal Creek was our camp. Our camp now is our River's Edge Academy. And having that camp authority gives the program a lot of flexibility in regards to they're in the facility, they're in the community, they're able to have just that flexibility in the program. So, you know, and when we think about placing kids in out-of-county group homes and things, there's a portion of money that the county has to pay for those placements. And so what we, in essence, did is we worked hard with the CEO at the time, Larry Lees, and one of the supervisors. We worked hard with our HHSA partners and the director at the time, and really proposed opening up River's Edge Academy and diverting those dollars that we would use to place kids out of county to keep them local and kind of reinvest with an a number of benefits, right? When you keep kids local, you keep them vested in their community, you keep pro-social supports, educational partners, family, you keep all that intact. And then you provide a treatment program to everyone, you know, the family, the youth. And the nice thing about Rivers Edge Academy is it has a treatment component and then it has a behavioral component. And so kids work, the youth work both sides of the program, and they're able to stay local. They're able to participate in different community events like the Trunk or Treat. They participate in a number of pro-social activities. When somebody advances or a new youth or something big happens, they go and celebrate and go have dinner in the community. They do different cleanup projects. They hike, you know, they get good exercise. And so it's really afforded us just this great opportunity to provide to our young people that need an out-of-home placement. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, where we went from having 20 to 25 kids placed out of county, I think we're down now to 5 or 7. And those youth require very specialized treatment that we can't provide in Rivers Edge Academy. And so really we're keeping those kids local. We're reinvesting our county dollars in a county program. We're seeing great outcomes. I think we have 11 youth in the program right now. We had our first graduation this last April, and we had, I think, six or seven youth. And so, you know, it's just a great opportunity. And the other thing that I'll mention that is just complements the program is that when a youth reaches a certain phase, they're able to be in the community and get a job. They're able to transition to a mainstream high school and then come back and get the support they need from the program. And so this last year, as we were approaching graduation, we had a number of youth that were attending school in the community, leaving their school program, going to work, and then coming back to the JRF, you know, and then spending the weekends with their family just to enhance that reunification process and to increase the success.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are, you may not be aware of this, but there are a lot of, I'm joking, people in the community who will see or understand restorative justice or rehabilitation, but come back to a belief that accountability is really important. Accountability is a word that, you know, has very strong energy, let's say, you know, in our community. And so I wonder how you speak to people who have a very strong focus on accountability, who may say, well, that's all well and good, but how are we making kids accountable? How do you navigate that? And what challenges does it present to the work that you do?
So accountability is actually one of the hardest pieces that we deal with, especially on the victim side. It's one of those things that I try to explain is you can't fix anything with just accountability alone. You haven't learned anything. And so when I say, yeah, I get that they did that, so let's help them learn not to do it again, not just holding them accountable and they're sitting there wasting their time or wasting their years, as I say, when we're talking with you. They have to learn to do better and they have to learn to be better. And the only way we can do that is by rehabilitating them. And so it's a big struggle because not everyone understands if my car gets broken into, I want them accountable right here and now. But it's about realizing that they're young, they're only children, they're teens, and some of them come to us much younger, preteens, and they're still developing. They haven't stopped developing, what does science say, until you're 26, and so they're still on that, trying to find who they are, and now you want to hold them accountable to, and I've heard it so many times, and they're like, well, you need to give them 10 years. And I'm like, what is 10 years gonna do? Is it gonna fix it? Is it gonna take back the time? Or can we help them now, and so that they go out there and no one else becomes a victim and no one else has to go through whatever the situation was. And so accountability is very hard, because if you look at it in other states, they still do very hardcore. Someone can do something at 12 and they're still paying for it at the age of 30. And it's just not how we are here in California. And it's not how we practice in Shasta County. It's about getting them that chance to have their best life and learn from it, actually learn from it and grow from it. And that just takes a whole team. And so accountability alone just does not work. And if you look at stats, and this is why we move this way, is we found that they recidivate, right? So we don't want them to continue to commit the same crimes, because they spent 30 days in the hall at that time. They spent 30 days and then now they're out one day and then they're going to spend another 30 days. That doesn't work. You have to give them services, and that's just the focus.
Yeah, and I'll just add, sometimes when I'm speaking about accountability and talking about accountability in the community, and it's really important to say that accountability looks different in many ways, and it's just not incarceration. There are other ways to hold people accountable. I was just at a day reporting center graduation, and several of the graduates said, "This was harder than doing jail time. Like, it's work. I gotta be here at my therapy every day. I gotta report. I gotta do, whatever the program's requiring, and it's hard." And so I think, just sharing that accountability can look different. It just doesn't have to be incarceration.
Thank you. That's helpful. The Shasta Equal Justice Coalition, as both of you know, is really concerned about issues of racial equity and equal justice. And you both and others at the probation and juvenile justice have talked about our demographics are so small and they differ. You've spoken about the focus on diverting youth if possible, keep your population as low. So that there's not a lot that has been evident in the population. But I'm wondering if you can speak to the kinds of inequities that the youth who come to you have experienced prior to coming to you. What we know that in California and in the country, there's certainly differential practices, especially with youth of color. And so I'm wondering what you have observed, what that means about how you approach integrating those youth, and how it's informed your own stance on equity.
So something that I've seen over the years that is consistent is from our Native American population, especially if they're in the Bernie area, our Fall River area, is that they come in very distrusting because of their prior experiences and lack of services. And so if they've, and that comes from all kinds of sides. So if I have someone and they reached out to maybe CFS or us for some kind of diversionary, but they're so far and they didn't get the help, then now we've lost the trust, and the trust is already very minimal as is. And so sometimes we're working through that. And I think the most important part of what we do is to make sure that we have those connections already in place, and we're working with the tribes to make sure that we're able to give services, get their input, make sure that we're all at the table together. Because when those are historically damaged, it's an uphill battle to say, "I'm here, I'm trying to help. We're not going to put you on an island by yourself. Like, we're going to do this together." And it's just having that teamwork has been the biggest struggle because of what's happened historically. And so those families that we have been able to help, we have been able to get services to them, have done amazingly well. But I will say that it is definitely an uphill battle just to make sure they feel equal, and that they're heard and they're not being just walked over, which is a big deal up here, is just saying, no, we're not trying to change who you are. We're not trying to take you away from who you are and your families. We have a lot of that of saying, especially when you get into placement situations. So when you get into placement situations, it's this thing, ICWA, that says you need to be with your family or someone of your background. And so when we get into those situations, it's like, we're going to try our best. We're going to try our best, but we're also delinquency. And the interesting thing about delinquency law with court, juvenile, is that it overrides all that. But we still want to make sure we take much consideration into it so that there's connections there for the duration of their life. So it is, sometimes we see it, especially coming in and trying to work through whatever happened prior of that makes it distrusting, and just making sure that saying, no, we're here for you, we're here to support.
And were you saying both in the team work that happens for the individual youth and also working to create the relationships for the next kind of relationships regardless?
Right.
To be able to
we want to have those
together.
There because if we right now it's gone, it's grown a lot, and I'm very, very thankful for a lot of the work that's happened to where I can send an email saying, hey, I have one of your kids, do you want to work together on this? Like, hey, I've been trying to get help for the longest, okay, let's do this together. And so we're getting to that place with a lot of with a lot of services and tribes in our area, which is very good, but it's still a work in progress to make sure that they know that we're here and we're reaching out. So it takes a lot on our part, as we have to reach out. We have to make sure they know that we care. So.
And that would be individual probation officers doing that?
Yes.
Yeah, so racial equity is very important to us, but I would say that there's other equities that we're, you know, looking at. We're looking at gender. Some of our population experiences poverty. And so really making sure that we, we're understanding the population that we're serving and really collecting the data so that we have a good understanding, and then making sure that we have the appropriate services and connections in the community to be able to provide to our youth and our families. And then also education of staff and really making sure that they're up to speed on understanding working with different populations in the best and most effective way. We, you know, we're really lucky. I was with Judy Flores recently, and she was saying we were able to apply for a Native American restorative justice grant because of your data. We asked a lot of questions in regards to, diversity and in data, and we needed, you know, this information to be able to apply for the grant, and probation had it. And they were able and successful in getting a 3-year grant, and some of the work that they're going to be able to do with the Native American population and restorative justice practices over the next 3 years is pretty incredible. So it felt pretty good that we had the data. And I think, you know, while it sounds silly, we need to collect that and understand it. It's just so important so that we really understand our inequities in our racial disparities and what's really happening in our community and with the population we serve.
And what are your, you know, as someone who has done equity training in the community, what are you finding are the greatest challenges to in explaining equity and doing professional development around that? You know, I have often found that explaining differences and barriers related to income, people can understand that pretty easily. A lot of us have had some experience with that. How do you address some of these other differences when you're talking about those intersectional identities, you know, LGBTQI status, racial differences? What are you finding and what seems to be working?
So what I think works is having that level of diversity within our department. Because Shasta County, the diversity is kind of limited. And so, but our department is actually really good about that. And so having that other viewpoint available has been able to say, this is what we experience, or this is what has been happening from the source, has been, I believe, crucial into just getting that understanding. Because sometimes you get, well, how do you know? And it's like, well, I'm living it, or I've been there. And so that having that level of diversity within our department has helped us challenge a lot of those issues.
And I think, Sharon, educating staff in talking about it, in really understanding the population is so valuable. That you know, everything that's going on, you know, the LGBTQ population plus, you know, it's, we provide a number of services and support because, you know, it's hard in general just to be a young person. You know, I'm raising a 17-year-old, and it's hard. And so I couldn't imagine, you know, what some of these kids are going through when we think about that LGBTQ plus population, and even some of our young people that are struggling with other issues. And so I think creating a staff, creating an environment to provide the level of services that we need in a supportive way, and really understanding the inequities and really what it means is just valuable. And we've done, Ebony, you want to talk a little bit about the GARE project and some of our work with GARE? It's so important.
So GARE is one of the projects, and I believe we started doing it prior to COVID, and it was supposed to address just equity across the board. So not just with the population we work for, but for hiring practices, retention. It was just to address everything that we'll see, equality issues. And so I love it. We did a lot of work on making a plan and how we're going to address, making sure we let people know, bring them in, bring all the right people in, make sure we're diverse, make sure everyone has a voice. But it also had an education piece to it. So we had, I believe, a lot of diversity training come from a lot of those meetings and trainings across the board. So it wasn't just probation sitting at the table for GARE. We had, I believe we had HSSA that was there as well. We had SCOE there as well. And so it was and is just an overall target of how can we really get the message across and make changes to our entire community. And so I love GARE for that. I do. I'm like, I'm waiting for another meeting, and I love my little updates.
Well, and I'll be sure to put, I think that's the Government Accountability for Racial Equity.
Government Alliance.
I think. Yeah. So I'll put a link to that also so people can learn a little bit about that. But as we wrap up, is there anything that you would like community members or organizations who are listening and thinking, I want to help in the work that you're doing, whether it's transition or preparedness or reaching out and relationship forming for those communities? Do you have anything you'd like to say to those folks?
So we're always looking for those who are willing to work with our youth, far as even if it's community service or support groups or anything that's going on in the community. I always have people drop off flyers and say, hey, we have this event going on. It's just very helpful. Word spreads. If we don't get the word, we don't know. So if you need to reach out, our information is on our website, which I'm sure we'll get up there.
We will.
And then we're also, and I know that Tracy can probably speak more to it, but I think just having quality programming in the community and diversionary programming in the community are essential, so we can negate having more kids come in, and we less is best. So.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and If you're listening, you've been listening to Bending the Arc and today's conversation with Tracy Neal and Ebony Higgs. You'll find lots of links in the show notes for things that they spoke to. And this is KKRN, community supported radio, supported by listeners like you. Thank you for listening.